In July 2005, in an abandoned building in Guatemala City, an archive of over 70 million documents, yes, 70 million, were discovered by human rights investigators. The records had belonged to the former Guatemalan National Police, contained evidence of crimes committed during the Civil War that lasted from 1960 to 1996. Now, the extent of these state-sponsored crimes was published in a report by the Historical Clarification Commission, Guatemala's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It detailed cases of torture, forced displacement, rape, sexual violence, forced disappearances during the war. And let us remember that an estimated 200,000 were killed or disappeared. Kirsten Weld is Professor of Modern Latin American History at Harvard. She's written a book called Paper Cadavers, about the discovery and rescue of the archive, and I welcomed her to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
How was the archive discovered?
Completely by accident. What happened was that in that hot summer, July 2005, there was a series of accidental explosions one night. There was a military base in Guatemala City that had been storing munitions, bombs, projectiles left over from the Civil War that you mentioned, but these were stored in improper conditions, and one night they just ignited. And so after 4 hours straight of explosions rocking the city, the residents of the adjoining neighborhood, who had good reason to suspect that there were similar storage conditions on a nearby police base, went to the country's Human Rights Ombudsman's office to file a complaint and ask the Human Rights Ombudsman's office to investigate the weapons storage conditions on the police base. So the Ombudsman's office sent investigators to this sprawling police compound on the northern edge of Guatemala City, and they indeed found more explosives that could have detonated and caused quite a good deal of human harm, but they also found piles and piles of old papers. And as these investigators had been charged with doing a risk assessment in the event of an explosion, and they had to identify flammable materials, originally their first concern was that these papers were flammable. So they asked the agent on duty, what's going on with all of these heaps of old papers? And the agent said, quite simply, these are the archives of the National Police. And their jaws just dropped.
Kirsten, the archives' existence had been denied for years at the highest level of government. So what was the reaction in Guatemala to the discovery? It must have come as an awful shock.
Did and it didn't at the same time. Human rights activists had never really believed their government's denials of the existence of these archives, or military archives or other kinds of state records for which justice activists had been clamoring to have access to for decades. So on the one hand, it verified something that everyone had always suspected, which was that the government had been lying about the ongoing existence of these records. But yes, at the same time, it was a tremendous surprise, not just that these records existed, but that they existed in such massive dimension, 80 million pages, and in conditions of horrific disrepair. So originally, at the moment of the discovery, it was not at all clear what was to be done with these records. Were they going to survive?
But there were some volunteers and workers who did get the job of sifting through them. It must have been very traumatic for them, because they would have come across names of people they'd known, perhaps even family members.
Perhaps even their own names in some cases. Basically the earliest volunteers who took on this very arduous task of trying to sift through literal heaps of rotting paper, moldy paper full of rats and fleas with bats flying overhead and in truly hazardous working conditions, were not just any old people plucked off the streets. They were, most of the time, people who had very personal reasons for wanting to learn the secrets of these archives, and precisely because they had been involved politically during the war as members of groups that had been targeted by the state, whether as trade unionists or students or, in a few cases, members of armed insurgent groups. And so It does not take very long in a country that's as small as Guatemala, sifting through these records, to recognize a name. And indeed, not every single day, but remarkably, they would find, a reference to a brother or a former partner or a classmate from school or a neighbor. And in some cases, these people survived, and in many cases, those people did not survive. And these mentions of their names in the archive was the sort of first clue as to what their fate had been. These are people who had simply disappeared, and all of a sudden, the archives offered the opportunity to figure out, in some cases, how they had died.
I'm talking to Kirsten Weld in Harvard about a remarkable book on a remarkable project. How did you get involved?
It was very serendipitous. I had been interested in Guatemala for a long time. I had always been interested in the sort of politics of documents, state documents, and declassification of documents, and what happens when state secrets become public. And I was in graduate school and sort of beginning to figure out what I would write my dissertation about. And literally it was as I was in the midst of that process that the news broke about the discovery of these archives. And I immediately, I read a tiny little news snippet. For about 6 months after the archives were discovered, the activists who were trying to marshal these records tried to keep a very low profile. They didn't publicize the news of this discovery to the world because they were very afraid that the archives would be shut down or burned down or taken away from them in some way. But when they did finally decide to go public, that's when I first heard about it a couple of months later. And I immediately had a million questions. What is this going to mean in this country where there's never been a single prosecution, a trial of any kind against any of these ex-military, ex-police officials who were very clearly involved in crimes against humanity? Are these archives going to change that? How are people going to manage this windfall of new information? What is going to be what are the destabilizing effects going to be? So from that moment on, basically, I put myself in touch with the project. It happened to be right at the moment at which they were thinking that some international exposure would help to protect them. And so when I got in touch and said, I'd like to write a book about what you're doing, I think it's incredible, they said yes.
But there were times when you were at risk yourself as a result.
Yes and no. The entire project has operated in constant conditions of risk ever since its inception, and it has suffered, as I write about in the book, Molotov cocktail attacks, political intimidation, the following and harassment of some of their staff, death threats. But I always felt while I was there that I was much safer as an outside observer than were my Guatemalan friends and colleagues who were doing the hard work of rescuing these archives day in and day out.
By coincidence, I was reading today an essay by an old friend of mine, a radical journalist called John Pilger, mm-hmm. who insists that the overthrow of the Whitlam Labor government was, in fact, manipulated to some extent by the CIA. Now, there's no surprise in knowing the CIA's involvement in funding and training armies in various Latin American countries against perceived mm-hmm. communist threats. That's well known. Guatemala, no exception. But you point out that what's less known is that in Guatemala, the U.S. provided similar support to Guatemala's national police, and this included support in record keeping. What was the logic behind that?
That's a very important and wonderful question. Basically, the CIA were involved in supporting a coup in 1954 in Guatemala that ousted a democratically elected president by the name of Jacobo Arbenz and ushered in a return to military rule. And shortly after that coup, the new leaders got in touch with the United States and asked for help in training their police. They basically wanted to have a more effective police force that would help them purge loyalists of the previous regime, people who they felt to be communists, who were just as often students or unarmed civil society members of opposition, political parties, progressive clergy, that sort of thing. But they wanted to optimize their crusade against what they saw as the left writ large. And so United States trainers came down and looked around and realized that the Guatemalans' record-keeping capacity was pretty terrible, and that it would be impossible for them to prosecute their counter-subversive campaign without a better archival management system. And if you sort of think about boiling it down, all police work is essentially the work of building an archive of society, right? What is a criminal background check if not making recourse to an archival record amassed over time? But in this case, they really wanted to rationalize archival production in the service of an anti-communist crusade. And that meant if you want to go after the communists, you need to know who they are, track where they live, track their daily movements, track who their friends are. And so that was really the purpose. There was a clear link between archival capacity and counterinsurgency.
Now, financial aid for the project was provided by various international donors with human rights as their priority, funds channeled through the UN Development Program. Mm-hmm. But the importance of handling the documents in an archivally sound manner was initially overlooked. Will you tell us how important the use of archival science is to human rights initiatives like this?
It's critical. It's absolutely critical. And this is not something that is immediately obvious when one thinks about, you know, we hear these stories periodically, new KGB records made available, or we're all familiar with the story of the Stasi archives. What we don't think about is, well, how are people actually going to use these records? If you've got 80 million pages worth of stuff in a warehouse, you've got to organize it in some fashion, or else it's going to be completely useless. No individual brain can keep track of the whereabouts and contents of that many pieces of paper without some kind of system. Nonetheless, when the activists who were involved in discovering the Guatemalan police archives first got there, they were understandably less interested in rebuilding the police's archival organization system and more interested in getting to the smoking gun content, right? Finding hard evidence on paper of crimes against humanity, of human rights violations. And so originally they weren't thinking too explicitly about how to organize everything. And it was really the influence of a few archivists, both Guatemalan and international consulting archivists, who told them, listen, we get that you want to do your human rights work. You want to get your evidence for your war crimes prosecutions. We absolutely understand this, but you need to understand that you're not going to be able to find and systematize and render useful that information unless you develop an archivally sound manner of handling these documents.
As the Luddites have to be dragged kicking and struggling into the 20th, let alone the 21st century, let me ask you this. Has much of the material been digitized? Can one now visit it on the internet?
You absolutely can. This has been one of the most amazing successes of an archival rescue project that in its early days, you know, it was very unclear whether or not this initiative would survive at all. And now it's almost 10 years old, and one of their main priorities has been precisely to digitize and make freely available as many of these documents as they can, not only because that is an important gesture towards building transparency and democratic access to state records, but also because digitizing the records is really the only way they can guarantee that, you know, if someone takes a Molotov cocktail to the building once more, tries to shut it down, does something to abrogate, to cut off the rescue project's access to the physical records, at least the digitized copies will survive. And so by now they've digitized about 15 million pages of these records, and you or I or anyone else can go consult them freely on a website.
Now, you talk about having to learn how to think archivally. What's that mean?
Well, it means, sort of briefly put, to think not only about what the words on the page of a particular document say, but how the document speaks to us in other ways, too. So not just what the text of the document may say, you know, I, police officer so-and-so, was involved in operation this and that, but also the type of paper that's used, the seals of receipt and sending that are on a particular document, the signatures, any marginalia, thinking about how a record can speak in other ways besides just the sort of explicit writing on the page, thinking also about archives not just as places where we find documents, but also as very, very powerful historical institutions which have a lot of mediating power in their own right. You have to think about these police archives, or any archives, frankly, not just as a kind of collection of individual records, but as the sort of sum of its parts, as a kind of elaborate machine where different arms of a particular bureaucracy will communicate with each other in pretty standard ways that can, you know, sort of that can be traced through looking at the documentary flow of records between different parts of a bureaucracy. If you actually kind of understand the way that a bureaucracy uses records, that an institution makes use of documents, then you can actually understand something about how that institution thinks. And so it's not just focusing on a particular page, it's trying to fit that page into a larger institutional and technical system of records management and therefore of institutional thought.
Kirsten, it took 15 years after the signing of the peace accords for the number of prosecutions for human rights violations in Guatemala during that war to increase from zero. How important has the discovery of the archive been in advancing the number of prosecutions?
It's been tremendously important and on a couple of different levels. First, just in terms of reviving a conversation, a national conversation about history and memory and justice, which in 2005 when the records were found was not quite completely stalled, but pretty close to it. And then secondly, of course, in terms of the archive's contribution to particular cases. And so there are now ex-police and military officials who are in jail because of these records. A few different very important cases that were prosecuted in 2009, 2010, 2011, led by a crusading new attorney general who sort of revolutionized the public prosecutor's office. And those cases simply would not have come to pass absent the discovery and the marshalling of these records.
But the biggest fish to be convicted was the former dictator.
Yes, yes. This is Efrain Rios Montt, who was the de facto head of state, has seized power in a military coup in March of 1982, was in power for about 18 months before he was ousted in another military coup. And just in that 18-month period, something like half of all of the deaths and disappearances that took place over the entire course of Guatemala's 36-year-long war took place just in those 18 months. So we're talking about an intense period of political violence.
You make the point, for all the ways in which this is a story about Guatemala, informed by the country's sobering specificities, it is not Guatemala's story alone.
That's true. Guatemala is a small country in the sort of the grand scheme of things, but it's a small country that has a lot to teach us, I think, about the relationship between information and power, the relationship between archives, knowledge, and political power, the exercise of political power. And so on the one hand, we can think of many contexts elsewhere in the world where in the aftermath of a dictatorship, a period of repressive or authoritarian rule, dissidents from those past regimes will immediately go to the archives to try to piece together what happened, right? And to try to seek justice for war crimes, to try to build national reconciliation in the aftermath of anti-democratic rule. So we, you know, see the use of, for example, the Stasi records in the reunification of Germany after the fall of the Berlin Wall. We can look at truth commissions like that in South Africa. There are many, many cases of truth commissions throughout the world that have precisely relied upon, in South Africa's case, of course, the records of the apartheid state as a way of reconstructing history and doing justice.
Well, even going back to the Eichmann trial, the proclivity of the Germans, of the Nazis, to be excellent record keepers is fundamental to the whole process of the whole judicial process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in fact, there's a Jewish emigre archivist who flees to the United States in the 1930s who says, watching the Second World War unfold, that the reason that the Nazis were able to amass as much power as they were was precisely because of the excellent nature of their record-keeping practices, which is just chilling to think about, but it's true.
The voice of Kirsten Weld, Professor of Modern Latin American History at Harvard, author of Paper Cadavers, The Archives of Dictatorship in Guatemala, published by Duke University Press. Coming up next, Eating Poor, How the Other Half Ate. The immigrants who streamed into the US in the late 19th century changed the eating habits of white Americans forever. Historian and lecturer Katie Turner is the author of the book, How the Other Half Ate, A History of Working Class Meals at the Turn of the Century, and she joined me from her home in Philadelphia. I began by welcoming her to our Little Whitest program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Have I woken you up at dawn's early light in Philadelphia? Is it pretty early over there?
Not at all. It's 8:30 in the morning.
Oh, that's quite civilized. Look, Katie, how on earth did you come up with this topic?
Well, I did some undergraduate work on canned food. I became interested in the development of canned food in the United States. But honestly, what got me started on this book was something that happened to me when I first moved to grad school and I was living alone. And I wanted to buy some popcorn at the grocery store. And I stood there in the grocery aisle and looked at the aisles of microwave popcorn, and then I remembered, oh no, I don't have a microwave yet, so I can't make popcorn. And then I, you know, came to my senses in a minute and realized, of course, you can make popcorn without a microwave, but it made me think about the fact that we're so constrained by our tools. You know, our mental possibilities are constrained by what we can cook and not just what we want to eat. And so it started me thinking about people with limited resources at the turn of the century and how they cooked, you know, what their process of thinking about food and cooking food was when they had limited resources and limited choices.
Now, Katie, although you're writing about the US, a lot of what you say clearly has, resonates in Australia, in that between 1870 and 1930, the period you're focusing on, there were lots of people arriving here, as in the US. Irish, yes, Europeans, Russians, in your case, South Americans, in our case, both cases, Chinese. Many diverse cultures, including their food, so the way they adapted to American food must also have been varied.
Certainly, yes, and I'm certain that's the case in Australia, too, as industrialization took place. These people came to work, and as I've found as I wrote my book, people went kind of one of two ways, is that they could stay with their traditional ways as much as possible, making as much food as possible, trying to get a hold of their, you know, traditional foodstuffs if they have to grow them if necessary, doing a lot of home food processing. Other people sort of jumped into the market and bought food rather than cooking it as much as they could. And many workers, especially workers' families, had a sideline of making food to sell to other people so that they wouldn't have to cook. Increasing amounts of processed and packaged food made this possible. So there are really two different strategies that we
And of course, if you came from the old world, in many regions, diets were pretty drab, weren't they? So they were quite excited at the possibility of eating more freely, where food was more varied and pretty cheap.
Certainly. Immigrants to the United States and certainly to Australia as well were amazed at how much meat people ate and that Americans ate meat every day. And more than once a day, whereas, you know, when these immigrants were coming from Europe, they were lucky to get meat once a month or a few times a year.
And, of course, they would have noted and responded to the fact that the American diet incorporated more cakes and other sugary foods.
Certainly, yes. A lot more cake, a lot more coffee, a lot more fats. In the United States right now, what Americans think of as Italian-American food is a certain kind of a variant of Italian food that was created when Italian immigrants came to the United States and suddenly had, you know, much greater access to meat and cheese and oil and sugar and all this, you know, and pasta, very starchy. So it made a very, you know, heavy, rich cuisine that people in Italy certainly did not eat like that.
I suddenly remember interviewing an executive from McDonald's on this program decades ago, and he made the point that McDonald's were a comparatively small fast food operation in this country compared to the Chinese restaurant. Chinese restaurants produce food pretty fast, and as a result of the gold rush and that huge influx of Chinese to come and work in Bendigo and Ballarat, etc., they set up Chinese restaurants in every part of this country. It's hard to find the tiniest town without a Chinese restaurant. Was that echoed in the U.S.?
Certainly. Fast food was a urban working class invention before middle class suburban people began eating it. Working class people bought their lunches out. They bought food to go. They had the men could get the free lunch at the saloon. When you bought a 5-cent beer, you would have access to the lunch counter, which was more or less, luxurious depending on the bar. They were buying their food at a time when middle class white women were still very much morally committed to cooking food for their family every day and mostly eating at home. And it's only in the United States after about the 1920s that large numbers of middle class people begin eating at fast food, eating out at restaurants more often.
My guest is Catherine Turner, and we're discussing Eating Poor, A History. And I should point out that her book is edible. This is the first time we've actually discussed an edible book on the program. Now, you write on page 8, Katie, that historical evidence about food habits remains elusive. We know more about urban people than rural, more about northerners than southerners, easterners than westerners. What about African Americans? What do we know about the influence they had in this era on eating?
Not quite. We know some, but not quite as much. And the reason for that is that a lot of the sources that I was able to use were from people loosely allied with the progressive movement in the United States, which was a social movement intending to improve the life of working class people, sort of, eliminate the bad conditions of industrialization while keeping the good conditions, the good bits of it. And the progressives were very interested in immigrants, in the recent European immigrants, because they were very concerned to incorporate these people into the United States. They were worried that the United States would no longer be American if too many immigrants came, and so they were concerned to help these people, but also kind of push them into line to be more like American citizens as they saw it. And so they focused a lot of their readings and their writings and their research on the immigrant working class, less so on the black working class. Although there were African-American progressives who were interested in their own community, there's much less information remaining.
Katie, one of the things you established quite clearly is poor people were paying a very high percentage of their income on food, up to 50%.
Very much, yes. Yes, and it was. I think that's the hardest thing for us to kind of wrap our minds around, because food now is such a low part of our budget. Comparatively speaking, food has gotten much, much cheaper. And at the time, it really was a serious budget item. It was more than rent very often for people. So they had to, turn their pennies very carefully when they thought about what to eat.
Okay, we're running out of time, and I'd like to go to the topic that I mentioned when introducing you, and that is bread. Tell us about what happened with bread and its significance.
Well, bread, of course, has a lot of, moral and symbolic components to it. And the progressives who did all this research on the working class really liked the idea of American women baking their own bread at home. And they thought that this was the American tradition, the colonial women, being very self-sufficient, performing this symbolic role for their family. But the plain fact was that people in cities bought bread from bakeries, because it just doesn't make much sense when you live in a, 8-square-foot tenement apartment to, heat up this enormous coal oven once a week to bake your own bread. It's kind of a time commitment, especially so when there's a baker on the corner who will sell you loaves for 5 cents each. So there's this constant sort of battle that the reformers are constantly pushing working class people to bake their own bread, and most of the working class women are saying, well, no, that just doesn't make sense for me. And the reformers putting kind of a lot of moral criticism on women for not baking their own bread, when really it just wasn't a practical choice to make.
Okay,
it was,
so
of course,
the eating
way of the future.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. The eating habits of the working class it's now become a new field of study, or did, I guess, when the issue of home economics crept into the syllabus. But there's still, it's still interesting that your book seems rather lonely on the shelves. There's not a lot of other stuff that I've come across.
There aren't. There's more and more great food studies being done in the United States, but the working class are still a little bit elusive because there just aren't great sources. But more and more, you know, work is being done, so hopefully we can keep developing this picture.
Historian Katie Turner. Katie's book, How the Other Half Ate, A History of Working Class Meals at the Turn of the Century, published on edible paper by the University of California Press. And that's another of our LML on RN Summer Specials. On our next program, Headaches. That's it for now. Stick around on RN, and I'll talk to you shortly.